Chapter 30. Paul's introduction to a new scene. Mrs. Pipchin's constitution was made of such hard metal, in spite of its liability to the fleshly weaknesses of standing in need of repose after chops, and of requiring to be coaxed to sleep by the soporific agency of sweetbreads, that it utterly set at naught the predictions of Mrs. Wickham, and showed no symptoms of decline. Yet, as Paul's rapt interest in the old lady continued unabated, Mrs. Wickham would not budge an inch from the position she had taken up. Fortifying and entrenching herself on the strong ground of her uncle's Betsy Jane, she advised Miss Barry, as a friend, to prepare herself for the worst, and forewarned her that her aunt might, at any time, be expected to go off suddenly, like a powder mill. "I hope, Miss Barry," apostrophe Mrs. Wickham would observe, "that you will come into whatever little property there may be to leave. You deserve it, I am sure, for yours is a trying life. Though there don't seem much worth coming into, you'll excuse my being so open in this dismal den." Apostrophe, poor Barry took it all in good part, and drudged and slaved away as usual, perfectly convinced that Mrs. Pipchin was one of the most meritorious persons in the world, and making every day innumerable sacrifices of herself upon the altar of that noble old woman. But all these immolations of Barry were somehow carried to the credit of Mrs. Pipchin by Mrs. Pipchin's friends and admirers, and were made to harmonize with, and carry out, that melancholy fact of the deceased Mr. Pipchin having broken his heart in the Peruvian mines. For example, there was an honest grocer and general dealer in the retail line of business, between whom and Mrs. Pipchin there was a small memorandum book, with a greasy red cover, perpetually in question, and concerning which divers secret councils and conferences were continually being held between the parties to that register, on the mat in the passage, and with closed doors in the parlor. Nor were there wanting dark hints from Master Bitherstone, whose temper had been made revengeful by the solar heats of India acting on his blood, of balances unsettled, and of a failure, on one occasion within his memory, in the supply of moist sugar at tea time. This grocer being a bachelor, and not a man who looked upon the surface for beauty, had once made honorable offers for the hand of Barry, which Mrs. Pipchin had, with contumely and scorn, rejected. Everybody said how laudable this was in Mrs. Pipchin, relict of a man who had died of the Peruvian mines, and what a staunch, high, independent spirit the old lady had. But nobody said anything about poor Barry, who cried for 6 weeks, being soundly rated by her good aunt all the time, and lapsed into a state of hopeless spinsterhood. "Barry's very fond of you, ain't she?" Apostrophe apostrophe Paul once asked Mrs. Pipchin, when they were sitting by the fire with the cat. "Yes," apostrophe said Mrs. Pipchin. "Why?" apostrophe apostrophe asked Paul. "Why?" apostrophe apostrophe returned the disconcerted old lady. "How can you ask such things, sir? Why are you fond of your sister Florence?" Apostrophe, "because she's very good," apostrophe said Paul. "There's nobody like Florence." Apostrophe, "well," apostrophe apostrophe retorted Mrs. Pipchin, shortly, "and there's nobody like me, I suppose. Apostrophe, ain't there really though?" Apostrophe apostrophe asked Paul, leaning forward in his chair, and looking at her very hard. "No," apostrophe said the old lady. "I am glad of that," apostrophe observed Paul, rubbing his hands thoughtfully. "That's a very good thing." Apostrophe, Mrs. Pipchin didn't dare to ask him why, lest she should receive some perfectly annihilating answer. But as a compensation to her wounded feelings, she harassed Master Bitherstone to that extent until bedtime, that he began that very night to make arrangements for an overland return to India, by secreting from his supper a quarter of a round of bread, and a fragment of moist Dutch cheese, as the beginning of a stock of provision, to support him on the voyage. Mrs. Pipchin had kept watch and ward over little Paul and his sister for nearly 12 months. They had been home twice, but only for a few days, and had been constant in their weekly visits to Mr. Dombey at the hotel. By little and little Paul had grown stronger, and had become able to dispense with his carriage, though he still looked thin and delicate, and still remained the same old, quiet, dreamy child that he had been when first consigned to Mrs. Pipchin's care. One Saturday afternoon, at dusk, great consternation was occasioned in the castle by the unlooked-for announcement of Mr. Dombey as a visitor to Mrs. Pipchin. The population of the parlor was immediately swept upstairs, as on the wings of a whirlwind, and after much slamming of bedroom doors, and trampling overhead, and some knocking about of Master Bitherstone by Mrs. Pipchin, as a relief to the perturbation of her spirits, the black bombazine garments of the worthy old lady darkened the audience chamber, where Mr. Dombey was contemplating the vacant armchair of his son and heir. Mrs. Pipchin, apostrophe, said Mr. Dombey, how do you do? Apostrophe, thank you, sir, apostrophe, said Mrs. Pipchin, I am pretty well, considering. Apostrophe, Mrs. Pipchin always used that form of words. It meant, considering her virtues, sacrifices, and so forth. I can't expect, sir, to be very well, apostrophe, said Mrs. Pipchin, taking a chair and fetching her breath. But such health as I have, I am grateful for. Apostrophe, Mr. Dombey inclined his head with the satisfied air of a patron, who felt that this was the sort of thing for which he paid so much a quarter. After a moment's silence he went on to say, Mrs. Pipchin, I have taken the liberty of calling to consult you in reference to my son. I have had it in my mind to do so for some time past, but have deferred it from time to time, in order that his health might be thoroughly re-established. You have no misgivings on that subject, Mrs. Pipchin? Apostrophe, apostrophe, Brighton has proved very beneficial, sir, apostrophe, returned Mrs. Pipchin. Very beneficial, indeed. Apostrophe, I purpose, apostrophe, said Mr. Dombey, his remaining at Brighton. Apostrophe, Mrs. Pipchin rubbed her hands, and bent her gray eyes on the fire. But, apostrophe, pursued Mr. Dombey, stretching out his forefinger, but possibly that he should now make a change, and lead a different kind of life here. In short, Mrs. Pipchin, that is the object of my visit. My son is getting on, Mrs. Pipchin. Really, he is getting on. Apostrophe, there was something melancholy in the triumphant air with which Mr. Dombey said this. It showed how long Paul's childish life had been to him, and how his hopes were set upon a later stage of his existence. Pity may appear a strange word to connect with anyone so haughty and so cold, and yet he seemed a worthy subject for it at that moment. 6 years old. Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Mr. Dombey, settling his neckcloth perhaps, to hide an irrepressible smile that rather seemed to strike upon the surface of his face and glance away, as finding no resting place, than to play there for an instant. Dear me, 6 will be changed to 16, before we have time to look about us. Apostrophe, 10 years, apostrophe, croaked the unsympathetic Pipchin, with a frosty glistening of her hard gray eye, and a dreary shaking of her bent head, is a long time. Apostrophe, it depends on circumstances, returned Mr. Dombey. At all events, Mrs. Pipchin, my son is 6 years old, and there is no doubt, I fear, that in his studies he is behind many children of his age or his youth. Apostrophe, said Mr. Dombey, quickly answering what he mistrusted, was a shrewd twinkle of the frosty eye, his youth is a more appropriate expression. Now, Mrs. Pipchin, instead of being behind his peers, my son ought to be before them, far before them. There is an eminence ready for him to mount upon. There is nothing of chance or doubt in the course before my son. His way in life was clear and prepared, and marked out before he existed. The education of such a young gentleman must not be delayed. It must not be left imperfect. It must be very steadily and seriously undertaken, Mrs. Pipchin. Apostrophe, well, sir, apostrophe, said Mrs. Pipchin, I can say nothing to the contrary. Apostrophe, I was quite sure, Mrs. Pipchin, apostrophe returned Mr. Dominy, approvingly, that a person of your good sense could not, and would not. Apostrophe, there is a great deal of nonsense, and worse talked about young people not being pressed too hard at first, and being tempted on, and all the rest of it, sir, apostrophe said Mrs. Pipchin, impatiently rubbing her hooked nose. It never was thought of in my time, and it has no business to be thought of now. My opinion is, keep 'em at it. Apostrophe, my good madam, apostrophe returned Mr. Dominy, you have not acquired your reputation undeservedly, and I beg you to believe, Mrs. Pipchin, that I am more than satisfied with your excellent system of management, and shall have the greatest pleasure in commending it, whenever my poor commendation apostrophe Mr. Dominy's loftiness, when he affected to disparage his own importance, past all bounds can be of any service. I have been thinking of Dr. Blimmers, Mrs. Pipchin. Apostrophe, my neighbor, sir. Apostrophe, apostrophe, said Mrs. Pipchin. I believe the doctor's is an excellent establishment. I've heard that it's very strictly conducted, and there is nothing but learning going on from morning to night. Apostrophe, and it's very expensive, apostrophe, added Mr. Dominy. And it's very expensive, sir, apostrophe returned Mrs. Pipchin, catching at the fact, as if in omitting that, she had omitted one of its leading merits. I have had some communication with the doctor, Mrs. Pipchin, apostrophe said Mr. Dominy, hitching his chair anxiously a little nearer to the fire, and he does not consider Paul at all too young for his purpose. He mentioned several instances of boys in Greek at about the same age. If I have any little uneasiness in my own mind, Mrs. Pipchin, on the subject of this change, it is not on that head. My son not having known a mother has gradually concentrated much too much of his childish affection on his sister. Whether their separation apostrophe Mr. Dominy said no more, but sat silent. Hoity-toity. Apostrophe, apostrophe, exclaimed Mrs. Pipchin, shaking out her black bombazine skirts, and plucking up all the ogress within her. If she don't like it, Mr. Dominy, she must be taught to lump it. Apostrophe, the good lady apologized immediately afterwards for using so common a figure of speech, but said, and truly, that that was the way she reasoned with him. Mr. Dominy waited until Mrs. Pipchin had done bridling, and shaking her head, and frowning down a legion of bitherstones and pankies, and then said quietly, but correctively, he, my good madam, he, apostrophe, Mrs. Pipchin's system would have applied very much the same mode of cure to any uneasiness on the part of Paul too, but as the hard gray eye was sharp enough, to see that the recipe, however Mr. Dominy might admit its efficacy in the case of the daughter, was not a sovereign remedy for the son, she argued the point, and contended that change, a new society, and the different form of life he would lead at Dr. Blimmer's, and the studies he would have to master, would very soon prove sufficient alienations. As this chimed in with Mr. Dominy's own hope and belief, it gave that gentleman a still higher opinion of Mrs. Pipchin's understanding, and as Mrs. Pipchin, at the same time, bewailed the loss of her dear little friend, which was not an overwhelming shock to her, as she had long expected it, and had not looked, in the beginning, for his remaining with her longer than 3 months, he formed an equally good opinion of Mrs. Pipchin's disinterestedness. It was plain that he had given the subject anxious consideration, for he had formed a plan, which he announced to the ogress, of sending Paul to the doctor's as a weekly boarder for the first half year, during which time Florence would remain at the castle, that she might receive her brother there, on Saturdays. This would wean him by degrees, Mr. Dominy said, possibly with a recollection of his not having been weaned by degrees on a former occasion. Mr. Dominy finished the interview by expressing his hope that Mrs. Pipchin would still remain in office as general superintendent and overseer of his son, pending his studies at Brighton, and having kissed Paul, and shaken hands with Florence, and beheld Master Bitherstone in his collar of state, and made Miss Panky cry, by patting her on the head, in which region she was uncommonly tender, on account of a habit Mrs. Pipchin had of sounding it with her knuckles, like a cask, he withdrew to his hotel and dinner. Resolved that Paul, now that he was getting so old and well, should begin a vigorous course of education forthwith, to qualify him for the position in which he was to shine, and that Dr. Blimber should take him in hand immediately. Whenever a young gentleman was taken in hand by Dr. Blimber, he might consider himself sure of a pretty tight squeeze. The doctor only undertook the charge of 10 young gentlemen, but he had, always ready, a supply of learning for 100, on the lowest estimate, and it was at once the business and delight of his life, to gorge the unhappy 10 with it. In fact, Dr. Blimber's establishment was a great hot house, in which there was a forcing apparatus incessantly at work. All the boys blew before their time. Mental green peas were produced at Christmas, and intellectual asparagus all the year round. Mathematical gooseberries, very sour ones too, were common at untimely seasons, and from mere sprouts of bushes, under Dr. Blimber's cultivation. Every description of Greek and Latin vegetable was got off the driest twigs of boys, under the frostiest circumstances. Nature was of no consequence at all. No matter what a young gentleman was intended to bear, Dr. Blimber made him bear to pattern, somehow or other. This was all very pleasant and ingenious, but the system of forcing was attended with its usual disadvantages. There was not the right taste about the premature productions, and they didn't keep well. Moreover, one young gentleman, with a swollen nose and an excessively large head, the oldest of the 10 who had gone through everything, suddenly left off blowing one day, and remained in the establishment a mere stalk. And people did say, that the doctor had rather overdone it with young toots, and that when he began to have whiskers he left off having brains. Their young toots was, at any rate, possessed of the gruffest of voices and the shrillest of minds, sticking ornamental pins into his shirt, and keeping a ring in his waistcoat pocket to put on his little finger by stealth, when the pupils went out walking, constantly falling in love by sight with nursery maids, who had no idea of his existence, and looking at the gas-lighted world over the little iron bars in the left-hand corner window of the front three pairs of stairs, after bedtime, like a greatly overgrown cherub who had sat up aloft much too long. The doctor was a portly gentleman in a suit of black, with strings at his knees, and stockings below them. He had a bald head, highly polished, a deep voice, and a chin so very double, that it was a wonder how he ever managed to shave into the creases. He had likewise a pair of little eyes, that were always half shut up, and a mouth, that was always half expanded into a grin, as if he had, that moment, posed a boy, and were waiting to convict him from his own lips. Insomuch, that when the doctor put his right hand into the breast of his coat, and with his other hand behind him, and a scarcely perceptible wag of his head, made the commonest observation to a nervous stranger, it was like a sentiment from the Sphinx, and settled his business. The doctor's was a mighty fine house, fronting the sea. Not a Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.